Even parchment crumbles. Extracts from the Perpetual Saga by Rod Summers.
We were talking about you.
Hey, I just don't care. I deny anything except perhaps feminist responsibility.
I could, were I so to wish, reroot time right here. There. With some history, it is possible to cite the beginning and from careful perusal of the surviving evidence to state a reason for the inauguration of the events. But here we are less clear about any of these things, and despite having had some time to settle, the view to this particular piece of the past remains murky at best. Reasons are appended to history during post-event documentation, and remaining vestiges of pre-event truth are often influenced or even eradicated by the contemporary fashion in political expediency. Love and the concept of peace are sometimes the trend, but never the norm. The days here described were barbaric. Axe and sword wielders, high on a mushroom called the Berserk Maker, proliferated in the Nordic lands. Bored insane from 4 months of sitting out the winter darkness, combined with a harsh life, fishing dangerous waters and farming where even trees must conform to survive the persistently interesting weather, the sons of the sons of the settlers were looking for trouble with an enthusiasm equal to that which they applied to looking for precious metals, stones, and honey. Here, then, are the remaining fragments, particles of at least three stories spoken many times and once written down. I leave you to draw your own conclusions concerning the veracity of any reality suggested, and to build anomaly-spanning bridges according to the specifications of your own perception.
The end of winter always feels unpleasantly distended, because the middle weeks of March each have two extra Odin's days. Away! You're obsessed with defining time, Bjolfr. Take my word for it. Mankind will never need anything more precise than the rising and the setting of the sun. The Romans have retired. Who's this mankind you're talking about?
The opening element of the story was discovered on a partial, much deteriorated manuscript, itself supposed a copy of the original. I was given considerable help in the translation from the original Icelandic by my esteemed colleague, Professor Paul Hermansson, a fine fellow of the old school. All that remains of this untitled saga is the beginning of an apparently longer story, a story now lost to us forever. But we are fortunate to have the composition of the raiding party described, and that gives us the connection to the events described in Orkney. But I get ahead of myself.
On the south coast of Iceland, the sands are black, and often subject to rearrangement from inclemency of weather or the anguish of the ocean. That and the naturally restless nature of rock and ice when united in a glacial-capped active volcano. Here, a little west of centre, there is a promontory where the great skua plunders. Man has farmed this area for some 80 years since the fraught days of the first settlements. Three young men take shelter in a cure house whilst the wind bites with ice. If it's this bitter down here, think how it will be up there on the plateau. This cold will take a greedy portion of the new lambs, said Maur, the youngest of the party. Well, why don't you go up there, Ulfur, and light a big fire for them, to keep them warm. And I'll come with you, Ulfur, and I shall be a big help, said the portly one of the three, and made ready to leave immediately. Nobody's going anywhere, Arwill, said Ulfur. And then, seeing that his words were wounding to his companion, he added, The storm will only last for the day, or two at the most. The strongest lambs will survive. Then he turned to Maur and asked, Did you see Siver bring in the boat yet? No, the wind blows too thickly to see much further than you can throw a horse. I'll go and have a look and see if he's back. I thought I heard a keel on shingle, but I'm not sure. We'll all go, said Ulfur. Later that late spring day, when the tide crest had already fallen, Sævar and Ulfur stood before their father, after whom Ulfur was named, and they put their proposal before him. It was Ulfur who spoke, as Sævar rarely had much to say. Ulfur told his father that they had finished overseeing the seeding of the fields and had completed those other tasks expected of them for the season, and now, as they had time on their hands before harvest, they wished, with the company of their friend Helgi Gislason, to take the family boat and go raiding to the south. Now it was often said of the father, Ulfur Egilson, who was known as Barking Uli in his Viking days, that he had let his sons run wild after the boy's mother, his wife, Arna Skallagra, had died in childbirth and taken his will and life joy with her to the grave. But the truth was that he had done his best to bring up his children and taught them well to survive the harshness of life on an island on the edge of the winter reaches of the infinite ice. He was not, therefore, inclined to refuse his eldest sons their request, for, apart from an unease within himself, he could think of no good reason to deny them. Pride pricked him when he thought that a family tradition was so eagerly undertaken by his own sons. He was not, however, at peace with the idea that their travelling companion should be Helgi Gislason, for the man had a reputation for being too often close to trouble, or even, and on several occasions, the very cause of it. The father gave in to his son's hunger when they honestly promoted Helgi's good humour, battle experience, and knowledge of the ways of the northern waters. And so they set about preparing for the journey. Helgi was determined to teach his dog named Algebra how to properly bury a bone before he set off on the spring raid. The dog watched attentively as Helgi patiently demonstrated the technique three times over, but despite the one's application and the other's persistence, the dog was unable to master the rudiments in the use of the pickaxe and shovel. The gathered friends of Helgi for whom he was performing laughed until they were weak from it. Amongst those gathered there was a man named Adelreich, one of the sons of Brithorn of Hetla. Adelreich was born not well of mind and grew large and awkward. His brothers, Nolani and Veiralt, did their best to protect him from the worst of dangers, and his good humour helped him to recover quickly from most of the accidents that with an unkind regularity befell him. Also there, drunk in the midnight daylight, were the sons of Blue Sim Barthur and Sistur, his sister. Dagr Heimerson was there, and of course Helgi's future shipmates, Ulfar and Sævar, with their younger brother Maur. There were many fine young Icelanders there that day-night who witnessed the moment when joy vanished like the northern lights to be replaced with the darkness of a starless winter night. A darkness that was to persist across many seasons. Helgi looked into the eyes of his dog and said, "A dog that's unable to bury his own bone stands but little chance of surviving the ages." The dog stared up in absolute faith and boundless devotion as Helgi composed this poem. "You're a daft dog, yar, algebra, algebra. You're a daft dog, yar, algebra. Your trust is unbounded, your friendship unbarred. You're a daft dog, yar, algebra." Staggering forward, laughing and shouting, "Stupid bloody dog!" came Adelrake, and before anyone could stop him, he lifted his hand axe and severed the dog's head with one stroke. Algebra's strong heart beat blood into its master's eyes, and desperate sorrow blinded Helgi further. Adelrake staggered back a pace or two, now suddenly sober and deeply shocked by what he had done. It was then, as Helgi knelt, incapacitated by grief, and Adelrake stood in no state to defend himself, that Maur rushed forward in youthful fury and delivered such a blow that his sword blade broke as it severed the life cord of the unfortunate Adelrake. Nolandi and Weirald drew weapons and prepared to kill their brother's killer, but the others who were there quickly came between them and the bloodshed was stopped. It seemed then as though the whole population of Iceland held a collective breath, awaiting the cyclic eruption of feud and counter-feud, expecting sorrow and death to cast a bitter blight over all the doings of man, and, in society, hatred becoming an acceptable obsession. But these inevitabilities were postponed as Helgi and his friends sailed on the first tide following the incident, taking Maur with them as this seemed the only way to protect his life.
Might as well ask, why is gold colored gold, or why does quicksilver not stay in the one place, as does real silver? A lodestone shows the way north on starless nights, and when all other signs are obliterated by the scudding of clouds. It is not necessary to know how the stone knows its direction, we just take advantage of its properties.
But... What if it goes wrong?
There's nothing to go wrong, and if anything does, the gods will protect us.
Since when? I'd rather know what's behind the thumb.
We will make sure soon enough. Forget about mechanics. Get ready to go looking for loot.
The second connection is composed of extracts from several manuscripts and journals, the earliest of which can be dated to within 30 years of the events described. I acknowledge that some learned people express doubts over the relevance of some elements of this Orcadian adventure, but I believe I am justified in my synthesis and that the links are quite obvious to the open mind.
Humanity will know he to wait until eternity for his evolutionary right to self-responsible personal liberty. It may well take 9,000 generations, or perhaps an external threat, a devastating plague or both and more, afore we are released from subjugation, and there is universal respect for the individual. Oppression will eventually be recognised as an untenable characteristic for the survival of the species, and the lust for power will be considered a serious disorder of thought. It will happen. For our money, he dreamed on it, for it to be excluded forever. We've had 1,000 years of formalized religion, and how far has it brought us? Our simplicity has manifest Almighty God as a human Son of God, allowing the clerics to have tied us down with chapter and verse. Few have felt the passion required by the profession. Few have felt the mystery of aware existence. Torn between turning the other cheek and girding myself with shield and sword, I stood by and watched raiders axe the life from my father's body as he knelt before the altar. I held myself silent and tried to become one with the shadows in our kirk. Neither sackcloth and ashes, nor an acolyte's cassock are any substitute for body armour, and martyrdom only works for true believers. One of the white terrorists stared into the dark space where I trembled, whilst the other two examined the metal of the altar fittings. One used the back of his axe to flatten the chalice, whilst the other unscrewed the gold crucifix from the base metal base before tossing the worthless part away. There being nothing else of value, and nothing to burn, the three adults, and a boy no older than myself, left after each had defecated in the centre of the aisle. But when three of the four perpetrators returned some months later, they were encumbered by a strange device which gave us the advantage. We attacked them with pike and stave and drove them to seek shelter in Orcahog. They dragged the device into the passage after them, until its many rare appendages became well and truly wedged against the walls, creating a most effective barrier against their escape and between us and our revenge. For a long while, fear of the machine and all its whirring and buzzing and lights inconstant but brighter even than stars, for stars cannot be seen in broad daylight, kept us at bay. We heard the clash of steel from within several times over the next few days and thought they must be either practicing battle or trying to dig their way out through the top. Also, all Orcadians were beginning to notice a shaking had taken to the earth and foulness could be tasted in the air, and that these manifestations seemed to emanate directly from Orcahog. There was a rapid increase in debilitating sicknesses, and the prices of certain herbs, known locally for their ability to purify, rose sharply. Eventually, a party of three brothers, including myself, crawled into the passage with ropes and attached them to those parts of the animated barricade which we could reach. When 9 or so ropes were attached, many pulled upon them, whilst others stood by with heavy nets to prevent the escape of the instigators of such havoc and grief. The machine came free quite easily, but despite its release, it continued to be the source of unspeakable unpleasantness. When the sole whole survivor came crawling from the passage, dragging a much injured colleague with him, we fell on them and held them to the ground whilst we removed their blood-stained weapons. They were much reduced by prolonged proximity to bad odours from the machine and hunger, for they had eaten nothing for days but the mushroom, they had brought with them, and those others they found growing within the chamber. The madness brought on by this fungal diet had caused the one to kill the older brother in order to save the life of the younger. Only the strongest of minds recover from such experience. It was obvious that in this state they posed no threat to us. We gave them a little food and water, and when they had regained what strength and sense seemed reasonably safe, we put them and the machine in a boat and sent them off with the final and solemn instruction that their return to Orkney would lead to their certain death at our collective hand. That was the gist of it.
Aye.
That is, more nor less, how I heard the story, direct frae the mouth o' the priest's youngest son. Of course, he was an old man by the time we spoke, wounded by callous destiny. Still sad, still full of regret and resentment, that emotional responsibility, and poetic justice, and hereditary instincts when applied to gene preservation. And it all ties in and adds up, you see. For I also had the good fortune to talk at length and many times over to Nan, the daughter of Omanin, herself the daughter of Erninin, last of the pure Picts. It was frae personal experience that Nan verified the hail incident and its consequences. She also telled me o' how, despite her pleadings to the leader o' this, the last Raiden Perry, they had stolen the holiest item o' the Pictish heritage, and even how she herself had, albeit unwittingly, assisted the theft. For you must have heard that the chief responsibility o' the Pictish womenfolk, locally kent as the Mound Minders over on Orkney, was to maintain the places where the Skye tribe's belongings were stored, awaiting the eventual return o' their rightful owners. Well, the most significant item in their care was a box which stood centrally on the flare of an intricately constructed square stained chamber, outside, turf-roofed in the round, which is there at this day and cried Maze Howe. The chamber can only be entered by a long, low tunnel with was a single, finely dressed granite slab. Three weir side chambers can be accessed frae the main chamber, and there's much runic graffiti cut into the stain adorning the wads o' the main chamber. But on the ceiling o' the central side, written in lamp oil soot, is this text. Fallowfield, in dateless state, wrote this. Nan tell me that the had occupied the same place in the building exactly as placed there by the Skye tribe's leader, Fo Brian, some 4,000 years afore Nan became custodian. Nobody kent exactly what the box contained, for them was curiosity had led them to open the box and look inside, was unable to put words of description to what it was that they saw therein. And them wha opened the casket and touched the contents in an attempt to learn o' its nature, or even attempted to reach out and touch them, deed in a lashing fire that lasted but an instant, yet reduced the rash to a smouldering brittle ash in a flash, a sicht mair bricht than daylicht.
The rest of the text is infuriatingly indecipherable. So now, the last and perhaps most tenuous connection, which comes from the Lyndon Lee Annals. Please note the description of a machine which is strikingly similar to that given at the end of the previous barley extract.
Barley always grew well round here, and we got plenty of sheep and honey too. Arr, there's no shortage of bees or flowers for them to suck upon, and them's the things in it. Them's the things what brought the raiders here in the first place. That and the white cliffs we got down here, right interested on our white cliffs they was. Seems they don't have anything like that where they come from. Most of their cliffs are black, it appears. Well, we didn't mind so much when they first came, because most of the time they would attack the church and the priests first. So we had time to run off and hide in the woods and wait until they went away, like. Then we'd come down and clear up and see if they'd left us anything. They really did. As the raids became more frequent, we began storing our supplies further and further from our dwellings, and we learned how to run real fast. The raiders took longer and longer to find what they had come for, until eventually they stayed over the winter, and Wessex was colonised by the Vikings, starting right here in Dorset. First, they lived frugally, just robbing us for only what they needed, till we had nothing of value left. 'Twas not a lot of fun for us peasants, twixt the Vikings on the shore and the barons on the hilltop. Well, eventually, of course, their own crops and sheep came on, and they took the pressure off of us. So some of us moved closer to take a look at them. For a long while, fear of the machine kept us at bay, with all its whirring and buzzing and then constant lights brighter even than stars. For stars cannot be when 'tis day. Then one of our girls, Heather or Grace or Nancy, for the life of me I can no longer remember who was the first, went over to visit without her knickers on. And then their women started visiting us, bringing strong drink with them and being really friendly. And in no more than 3 seasons, they changed from newcomers to neighbours. They certainly know their sheep, and their women are lovely. Tomorrow, one of our girls shall wed the one that owned the strange box he bought from the north with him, and then sold it on to a visiting man named Sonny Boy Fuji for a very large amount of coin. I'll say this for them. Since they've been here, we've had plenty of traders passing through. I've sold sheep to every colour of man you could think of, and likely a few more besides, I should say. So I have quite a little pile of coin back home. Not much I can do with the stuff, of course, but it does come in handy for paying the protection tax the Vikings persist in collecting.
As Helgi drew close to the shore at VP Meerles, he was greeted by the smell of puffin grilling on charcoal, and the cheering and shouts of welcome from the group of men gathered on the volatile border between lava sand and wave. He recognized friends and their state by their gait. Beside him sat his new bride, now finely attired, as befits the wife of a very rich man.